I'm here with Thomas Schwartz, author of Henry Kissinger and American Power, a political biography, to discuss the reputation and legacy of Henry Kissinger a year after his death. Thank you, Tom. You title your biography a political biography of Kissinger. Why did you do that?
Well, I have to say that suggestion actually came from my editor, because as he read it, he recognized that I was not trying to delve deeply into Kissinger's private life, that I was basically trying to do something about what he had done publicly. And I think as he read the manuscript I was giving him, he recognized that my emphasis was on Kissinger as a political actor. And this was, of course, what I think is my modest contribution to the Kissinger literature, is to see Kissinger as much more of a political figure, as someone who understood politics, who recognized the impact of domestic politics, who tried to help his presidents win elections and create a greater political coalition behind them. And I think that led to his suggestion that I title it a political biography, with the title that I had given it of Henry Kissinger and American Power. And I'm actually very, very pleased that he did, because I did not want to confuse people with the idea that I had had any of the last word about Kissinger's private life, or even explored deeply the types of things that a traditional biographer would do.
Because obviously your book captures Kissinger the scholar, Kissinger the statesman, but also I think Kissinger the performer, which now, a year after his death, he died at 100, a year after the Kissinger century ended, I think there's an essence to that. It's quite fundamental in terms of how he presented himself.
Yes.
And understood how to play the political game in that regard.
Well, yes, and again, one of the major themes of the book is Kissinger as someone, I call him one of the greatest self-promoters in American history. That's a bit of a line, but I also emphasize, and this was because of the special collections that were in existence at my university, namely the recordings of the evening news, in which you could see him emerge on what was the most popular media in the United States at that time, television news, in terms of how people got their news, and how Kissinger handled himself on the media, and how he became a very skilled performer in dealing with visual media as well as newspapers. I should have added, he courted and was very successful in conveying his ideas and also developing friendships with various media figures, particularly the New York Times and Washington Post, which he was quite close to, but also in many other newspapers, as well as magazines, Newsweek and Time, which played a significant role in shaping American public opinion during this era. And his television presence, which continued, of course, after he was Secretary of State, and remained a television figure of great note, always interviewed when foreign policy crises came. And it was one of the things that kept him in the public eye up until his death. He was still a figure who could command media attention.
So do you think that's one of the reasons that he's actually endures much more than his predecessors or successors as national security advisor, is that he was able to tap into a television age of evolving media, evolving technology, and sort of slot in very well there?
Yes. Yeah, I think that was. He was probably not as adept at some of the rapid-fire types of talk shows and other things that began to develop in the 2000s and others, because he did have a tendency to talk more slowly and in more complex terms about international affairs. But I think he nevertheless was very, very good at handling the media of his time and becoming really a well-known figure, so well-known in the country that he appeared to be in charge. People thought of him as the person running foreign policy, and his approval ratings were, by comparison to any even subsequent Secretary of State, extraordinarily high, in the 80% range for a time. And he was one of the most admired Americans for 3 years in the 1970s. And I think that does speak to his ability to connect and to convey this sense of someone who had American foreign policy in charge and was handling it.
I mean, he's not, however, based on his, well, should we say, look and voice, not someone you'd have traditionally expected to be a particularly adept media performer.
Yes, so, that was, actually one of the things he played upon and was frequently commented on. I talk in my book about his reputation as a ladies' man during the administration and the fact that he dated beautiful actresses. But the contradiction between his own sort of physical appearance and these beautiful women sort of flocking to him made him even more of a celebrity or sort of a person of notice. And the media enjoyed it greatly. And even his marriage to Nancy did not change that as greatly as you might seem. Although I think it was something of an act, something of a way of distinguishing himself within what was a relatively bland administration, the Nixon administration. And it was catnip for the media of Washington and then later for the country as a whole.
So how did Washington and the rest of the country regard his Germanness? Because the distinctive accent, I think, is going to be one of the most defining qualities to him.
Well, this is interesting. It's hard to actually find specific evidence of this. But, of course, Kissinger was kept away from the television media directly in the first Nixon administration. The argument was he wouldn't play in Peoria. There was this sort of notion that his German accent made him sound like Dr. Strangelove, and this was not the way the Nixon administration wanted to appear. And they kept him away. And in fact, one of the interesting things I found in my research of the television media was a Dan Rather report on Kissinger's press conference after Nixon's speech of 72, where he revealed that Kissinger was acting as his personal emissary in secret negotiations with Hanoi. Dan Rather comments, "We can't actually give you the sound from this because of White House restrictions." And this is ridiculous. But eventually, of course, the White House caved. And Kissinger's first major appearance comes, of course, when he gives his famous press conference in October of 1972 and announces peace is at hand, a quotation that would get him into a lot of trouble when things at least didn't immediately appear in Vietnam to be peaceful. But his press conference, which was covered on all three networks, and is one in which Richard Nixon called him up afterwards and sort of congratulated him on it as a way of putting, you might say, Nixon's campaign over the top against George McGovern, even though I'm sure he would have won anyway. He saw it as really having now announced that peace was at hand in Vietnam, that he would win in the landslide that he did win.
Yeah. So do you think his Germanness surprised audiences then?
I think it became
out.
A part of his sort of character. I think it was the Germanness was taken away a bit by the fact he was Jewish, and the knowledge that he was Jewish relieved some of the notion that he had any sort of lingering right-wing or Nazi-type attitudes because he was Jewish. And I think in the end, for a time, he became a sort of Horatio Alger-type figure. I actually found myself, when I was writing the book and the Obama phenomenon occurred, that there was a similarity in the way Kissinger was treated with the way Obama was treated, in the sense that Americans were extraordinarily proud of the idea that a man of Kissinger's foreign origins, who had been a refugee and a persecuted, could rise to such high stakes, such a high position in the United States. And there were indeed in the period attempts to change the law that would have allowed Kissinger to run for president by changing the birth law. We have against allowing anyone who's not born in the United States to become president. And I saw a sort of comparison there to the sense, of course, of Barack Obama's the first African-American to be rising to that occasion. So I think Kissinger benefited from a sort of American exceptionalist view that anyone can rise in the United States despite their origins. And he himself often commented on that, And when he became Secretary of State, he began his remarks after being sworn in by saying, "Nowhere in the world could a man of my origins have risen to this position."
I mean, I think what's interesting about how Kissinger cultivated his public persona is he's very proud of being an American and emphasizes that through his career. But at the same time, he does cultivate his Germanness intellectually. He writes about Spengler and Metternich, and he's very much considered to have a sort of German sensibility, a pessimism, a Weltschmerz, and that really does factor into that.
It does among some.
Okay.
And here I would put a difference between people who either knew him well and knew his background well and would talk about it, and those who sort of saw him only performing. One of the sort of moments I remember in terms of his media was when he went back to Firth in December of 75 to receive honors, and how that was covered in the media as the return of this refugee back to the land of his origins. And I think his connection to Germany was there, but it was in many respects, because he was Jewish, I think it was seen in a much more positive light than it might have otherwise been seen. And I think somewhat of the comparison between sort of the reception of him as a German and Szpig Brzezinski as a Pole afterwards as something of the similar type of thing. Again, the immigrant rising to such a high position of power.
I found in my research that he does have an intellectual fascination with German history He tries to trace German history from the Congress of Vienna, which is the subject of his first book, through Bismarck, which was, he was meant to write a biography of Bismarck, but then he entered office. And then after Bismarck to the First World War, and out of the First World War, the rise of Hitler. And so he does, I think about that quite actively, and it does factor into his personality, but also just his general approach to international relations. I think Kissinger's association with the 19th century, with the Congress of Vienna, with figures like Metternich, is fundamental to his intellectual reputation and importance.
Yes, and he actually, the Metternich comparison came up a lot. Not that many Americans knew who Metternich was or who actually talked about, but when he gave his famous interview with the Italian woman journalist that got him into such trouble, he made a big point of saying, I am not a Metternich. Yeah. I'm actually influenced by other thinkers. And I think certainly among intellectuals, the comparison, the Metternich, the secret diplomacy, all of that was certainly there. But I think in general, the larger public opinion frame of Kissinger in the United States was as someone who's really smart, which it did help, of course, that he had an accent, because I do think Americans sort of attribute a certain intellectual strength to European accents, British accents, German accents, in the sense that they might not attribute to someone without that accent. And I think he gave off this impression of great knowledge, which of course was true, but it was also the case that he was, I think, seen as an intellectual and as someone who provided the brains. This was, of course, the other notion was that he was providing the brains to the Nixon administration, something that Nixon, of course, found very objectionable and was quite distressed by, but was certainly out there as the that he was the source of the ideas of the administration.
One of the distinct qualities about Kissinger is that he's not the only Harvard intellectual to enter the U.S. government. He's not the only former immigrant to have the role of national security advisor. But he does stand out against Walt Rostow, against McGeorge Bundy, against Zbigniew Brzezinski. Why do you think, even now we're here in the Kissinger Center, he is different?
Well, I think one thing is, of course, that he accumulated so much power. Political scientists rate him as one of the strongest secretaries of state. And I think what one has to realize that as national security advisor, he was subordinate to Richard Nixon, but when Richard Nixon encountered Watergate and was weakened, he tried to hold on to Kissinger, but Kissinger was the one calling the shots. Yeah. I think Kissinger called the shots in much of the Middle East negotiations. And when Gerald Ford came into power, Ford essentially delegated foreign policy to him, only to try and take back some of it because it did hurt him politically. But for 8 years, he played a substantial role. And then in the final years of his time there, he was seen as one of the most powerful figures in Washington. And although other national security advisors certainly had influence, McGeorge Bundy, you mentioned, Brzezinski, others, no one really came to having quite the degree of almost, I, of course, in my book, referred to him as almost the president for foreign policy during a period of time. Having that type of authority and that type of power in the position he was, I think, separates him from others who've been in that position. And I think that is truly distinct, and I think is one of the reasons why he remained so consequential afterwards.
So there was a lot of luck in it.
Fortune, luck, also luck, the opportunity which he seized and used effectively. He was an absolutely skilled bureaucratic infighter, skilled in cutting out the State Department from the influence it had over foreign policy when he was National Security Advisor. And then when he became State Department head, he was still National Security Head, so he had combined those two positions. So, yes, he had a certain good fortune in how things developed. But I in my book, I talk about how Nixon, in effect, created his Frankenstein. He built up Henry Kissinger and relied on him, although I think Nixon contributed a lot of the ideas himself. But then ultimately, Kissinger would be the survivor of the Watergate scandal and then become such an important part of the Ford administration as well.
I mean, the relationship with Nixon is so important to Kissinger, but where did it come from? Because before Kissinger was appointed, he'd only met Nixon once. He didn't think he was going to be appointed National Security Advisor when he was phoned up in 1968. It was a surprise, but they gradually built perhaps the most consequential relationship between a National Security Advisor and president in American history.
Well, I think Kissinger worked very hard at it. He used all of his, I think, emotional intuitiveness, understanding, psychological insight to basically understand Nixon, who was a contradictory figure, whom he knew had certain suspicions about him as a Harvard intellectual, and the associations Kissinger had with Nelson Rockefeller, his rival, the associations Kissinger had with a lot of the liberal elites in Washington who liked him but hated Nixon. But he used all of that to cultivate Nixon. And I think the tapes have an interesting portrait, because obviously they show Kissinger oftentimes being very fawning and reassuring to Nixon, who had deep insecurities about his performance as president, and Kissinger reassuring him. But at the same time, they show how perceptive he was of what Nixon wanted to do, and the degree to which Nixon provided sometimes the will to power that Kissinger lacked. I think of particularly of Nixon's willingness to undertake in Vietnam forcible measures that Kissinger advocated but would have been reluctant to fully engage in. And so Kissinger sometimes tried to tell people outside that he wasn't really on board for Nixon's bombing and mining of the Haiphong port in May of 1972, or the Christmas bombing in the end of 1972, but he wanted to be able to preserve a certain access to the people who opposed Nixon, but Nixon did it anyway. Nixon's willingness, for example, to send enormous supplies to Israel at a point where Kissinger was trying to leverage and not lose support among some of the Arab states also showed a powerful will. And I think they were an effective partnership, a very effective partnership, not a friendship, not emotionally close by any stretch of the imagination. But as we heard last night, we had the privilege of hearing from David Kissinger about the relationship. There was a sort of, Kissinger did have a deep understanding and a recognition of Nixon's achievements that he was willing to, even after Nixon's resignation, to try to bring Nixon back into the sort of mainstream mold by figuring out ways to introduce him to people who would listen to Nixon and actually rehabilitate Nixon somewhat in the American psyche. And I think that was part of that relationship. But it's complex. I think in my book, I probably put more emphasis on the degree to which Kissinger manipulated Nixon. And I think were I to rewrite it or to rethink it, I think there was a degree in which there was a manipulation as well as an appreciation for Nixon's qualities as well in that effort.
What has made you change your mind?
Maybe listening to more tapes with more nuance, recognition. I listened to a lot before I wrote the book, but I've continued to listen since as they've been released. And I think it was complicated. It does have dimensions to it that I did not appreciate fully. And maybe a little bit of hearing from people like David Kissinger about Kissinger's genuine feelings toward Nixon, which I may have discounted a bit more. But I've seen, for example, I've seen videotape of the obituary that Kissinger provided at Nixon's funeral and others, and to see it more as a gesture of sincerity than as a conscious or cultivated effort to hide his own manipulation of Nixon.
Yeah, because a lot of the Kissinger reputation is built on the balance with Nixon.
Yes.
On both the partnership, but also on essentially Nixon's insecurities and problems through Watergate. So, for example, in September 1973, Nixon is very drunk, essentially, during Watergate, and Kissinger takes charge, raises the emergency threat level to DEFCON 3. Right. So they balance each other.
Well, that was a particularly difficult time for Nixon. And I do think the degree to which Watergate wore Nixon down, and then the revelations, the firing of Archibald Cox, and the impeachment chorus, Nixon became ineffectual, and in a sense, Kissinger had to step in. But even after that, there was a degree to which Kissinger had to deal with Nixon and use Nixon effectively in his shuttle diplomacy and negotiations in the Middle East. But I think he was, after that point of sort of late 1973, I see Kissinger as largely calling the shots on how he wanted to conduct diplomacy until Gerald Ford comes along.
And I think it's striking that just for constitutional reasons that Nixon's resignation letter is addressed to Kissinger.
Kissinger as Secretary of State. Remarkable in that sense, the irony that contains.
Yeah. I mean, Kissinger he lives for another nearly 50 years.
50 years.
After his, and he continues to cultivate his role, his reputation, his memoirs. I mean, they have the equivalent of 3 pages for every day he was in office.
Yes.
A true case of if history's going to be kind to him, for he intended to write it himself. Mm-hmm. But he, as you said earlier, he becomes talking head on the media circuit. He goes into business. He sort of does tap into the changing world of American media and foreign policy outside of government as well.
I also think, though, he desperately wanted to come back into power.
Yeah.
And I think this was the irony for Henry Kissinger, was that he had accumulated so much power during the Nixon and Ford administration that no president was eager to let him back into that. And I talk about this particularly with Ronald Reagan. Not that Reagan would have ever appointed him, but that Reagan's people around him were very cautious. And I do think Gerald Ford, for example, and this was one of the stories that David Kissinger told me that did not come out last night, but that Gerald Ford wanted to bring Kissinger back as his advisor if he ran with Ronald Reagan in 1980, which was briefly discussed.
As Reagan's vice presidential candidate,
he wanted Kissinger to be Secretary of State, and Reagan said this was impossible, and this became a deal breaker for that. And David Kissinger put it that Kissinger himself understood that it would be a deal breaker, and that may be the case. I think, though, Kissinger desperately wanted to be back into the mix of power and hoped it would come under Reagan, and then later hoped it would come under Bush, his successor, but that never happened. And I think only by the 1990s does he become reconciled to the fact that he is not going to be in that position. Yeah. Although he relished, of course, the degree to which Vice President Cheney called on him for advice during the Bush administration, the second Bush administration.
Well, we heard from David Kissinger, Kissinger's son, yesterday about the relationship between Kissinger Sr. and Nixon. And it was never close, but they did share a sort of insecurity and a sense of being on the defensive from, the liberal New York media elite.
They shared an insecurity, and then they shared a sense that they were doing things that the bureaucracy couldn't, that they two alone were managing, especially when the China relationship came, that this was something they had done.
Yeah.
Kissinger quickly figured out how significant this was, even though he had never spent much time thinking about China in his earlier career, and then became sort of excited by it, as David Kissinger actually talked about how much the China relationship mattered to his father. Mm. And I think Nixon and Kissinger together saw themselves as really remaking the international system, remaking the situation of American foreign policy through their maneuvers. I think that bonded them in a way that was quite extraordinary.
Yeah. Kissinger has really owned the opening to China ever since. I think he probably would have cited it as his proudest policy achievement. And he built a lot off that.
Yes, indeed. And controversial in some ways, because, of course, he also had an enormous amount of business dealings with China and that. But he, I do think he would have cited it as his proudest achievement, even though in my book, I also see his Middle East role as very, very significant. But I do think China played such a key role in his life, all the way to the end when he went to see Xi Jinping when he was basically 100 years old. And, you know, it was a very strenuous journey for him to go to China in July of last year. So I do think it was key. I think he found some of the controversy over China recently disheartening, partly because, of course, I think he hoped for a better relationship between the United States and China that seemed to be developing. And I think this was a source of great concern for him in the last few years.
Mm. How does Kissinger the politician, in your book, deal with the aspects of his career that are considered controversial? And this is just a central piece of Kissinger's legacy.
He handled some well and some not so well. I think there were some that he got very defensive about almost immediately. His role in spurring and guiding some of the covert activities and the efforts that sought to undermine Salvador Allende in Chile was something he was very defensive about in terms of what had happened, the consequences, the human rights violations afterwards. And he handled that. He could be very aggressive in handling and being defensive about what happened. And that certainly was not very effective. On Vietnam, he could be very defensive as well, although intriguingly enough, I think in many respects, some of what went on in Vietnam has been put more into perspective by some of the newer historical literature and others about the nature of the Vietnamese Civil War and the dilemmas the United States faced. On some other controversies in his career, I think particularly of his role in supporting Pakistan in the Indo-Pakistan War, was something he could be also pretty defensive about in terms of thinking that Pakistan's centrality as a link to China was more important than some of the human rights abuses of the Pakistani army inflicted on Bangladesh. There were other controversies, of course, but he varied because he could be quite open in talking about issues on the Middle East and others, but then in some other areas he would get very defensive, and his supporters and others tried to deal with opposition quite harshly sometimes, and there were controversies about people at the Council on Foreign Relations who were not hired or hired because of Kissinger's influence. And, you know, there are still papers that he's kept from being used by critics because of that. But I think the Christopher Hitchens attack on his morality, the idea that he's a war criminal, certainly didn't help matters, and he found himself in some very nasty debates toward the end of his life.
So, you know, a year after his passing, what do you think has changed about perceptions of Kissinger since his death? And where do you see ideas of his contribution and role going?
Well, I think it's too soon. The Kissinger papers and more materials will be available. There'll be opportunities for more balanced assessments. I do think one thing that certainly occurs to me is just the immense difficulties of managing foreign policy and the degree to which I think secretaries of state or others who played a role in at least diffusing crises and creating peaceful conditions will be seen more positively in terms of their achievements. And I think Kissinger's success in balancing the Soviet Union and China, in particular his triangular diplomacy, there are people who want to cling to that and think that it could be a solution for the United States now in trying to separate China and Russia, although I think the situation is very different now. I think some of what Kissinger tried to do, I think Anthony Blinken was trying to do something similar with shuttle diplomacy recently, and it came up in a number of comparisons to his efforts to try to tone down what was going on in the Middle East and that in terms of that. And I think Kissinger's achievement there is more appreciated now given the horrific problems that have developed there. So I think Kissinger might be appreciated more in certain respects, and then in other areas might also encounter more criticism as more materials become available. I think a balanced assessment of Henry Kissinger is not something I think I'll live to see, because I think it's going to take a long time for historians who are not caught up in the passions that Kissinger intensified and were part of that era to look at his record in a more objective way. As a historian, I'm aware that particularly difficult times in our history, the Civil War, for example, some of that, it takes a long time for people to sit back and develop a more balanced appreciation. And I think to a certain extent, Kissinger was a figure in our leadership during the 20th century equivalent of a type of civil war, the polarization over the Vietnam War, that cast all these issues in a very emotional and highly partisan at times light. And it'll take some time for people to stand back from that and appreciate either his contributions or his mistakes.